This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Sometimes it's hard to separate fact from fiction, and this can be especially true when it comes to modern politics, which often blurs the line between the two.
I'll be back. I'll be back.
I'll be right back.
I'll be back.
I'll be back.
I'll be back.
I'll be back.
I might be back.
She'll be back.
I'm back.
I'm back.
Well, he means it every time he says it. Yes, the one-time muscle man who morphed into a Hollywood icon and then became California's governor returns on the screen as the Governator.
Governator is action comedy.
There we go, Governator. Easy target, of course, bodybuilder turned actor turned politician. But the fact of his election does raise some interesting questions about the political process. How important is it for a politician to be a good performer? Is a well-produced, smoothly produced script and a message necessary to win an election? Theater and politics are closely linked today, and they've been feeding off one another since ancient times. My guest today says it's likely that theater played a pivotal role in the development of democracy. Peter Burian is a professor of classical studies and theater studies at Duke University, and he's here in the studio. Peter, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
Also with us today in the studio is Jules Odendahl James. She is a resident dramaturg and visiting lecturer at Duke University. Welcome to you, Jules.
Thank you very much.
Peter, what's the relationship between theater and democracy? Did one lead to the other? Did they support each other in ancient Greece?
It's a complicated question because our best evidence, anyway, is that theater is part of the great festivals of Dionysus that were sponsored by the Athenian state, came in at the very end of the tyranny, the Pisistrated tyranny that ended almost at the end of the 6th century. But it very soon becomes an institution of the democracy, by which I don't mean necessarily a supporter of every democratic idea or of democratic politics as such, but as an institution that participates in democratic discourse. So you will find, first of all, it's dialogic. We can't really say Sophocles says this. We have to say Oedipus says it or Jocasta says it, right? And it's all about debate, about discussion, about back and forth. So there are no simple statements of truths. Even the chorus can notably be wrong and does not always represent some accepted view. This also doesn't necessarily mean that the theater is by nature sort of contrarian. What it means is that it opens up a kind of free discussion about all kinds of issues in all kinds of ways, including dissent from democratic practice. Comedy has a great, and tragedy too, actually, has a great line in sort of how ridiculous the popular assembly is. And yet the theater of Dionysus contains that same citizen body ranged more or less as the way they were next door at the Pnyx when they voted on legislation.
So the audience sitting in the theater would look an awful lot like that deliberative body next door.
They would.
And there are people discussing things. There is that agon, that struggle, a dialogue. That suggests some kind of struggle.
Yes, and among other things, one of the meanings of the word agon, contest, is that the theatrical festival itself was a contest. There was a very elaborate voting process to see who won first, second, and third prize.
So there again, a kind of support for this process that is at this moment uniquely or characteristically Athenian. To what extent, what do we learn if we look at the evolution or the trajectory of the three greatest ancient Greek playwrights, if we go from Aeschylus to Sophocles to Euripides? Is there anything in what happens over time and their innovations that in any way reflects the evolution of democracy in Greece?
Well, the ancients themselves seem to have thought so. At least Aristophanes, the great comic playwright of the 5th century, has Aeschylus accuse Euripides of letting slaves, old women, young women, fools of all sort talk, and he has his Euripides answer, yeah, that's because I'm a democratic playwright. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, you find non-citizens, women, slaves, foreigners in great numbers in Aeschylus too. You find political debate of a certain kind. But Euripides is probably more transparent in effect, alluding to current issues and problems.
Of course, he's the latest of the
three. Aeschylus is there pretty much at the beginning. Aristotle says he introduced the second actor, which means that he introduced drama as we understand it.
There can now be a conflict between two individuals on the stage, not just the chorus, whatever they represent, and an individual.
Exactly.
Well, let's take a look at the content, too. To what extent did they reflect the tensions within society? And why don't we just pick Oedipus Rex, since a lot of us know about that? Is there anything in the content of that play that reflects a tension within Greek society at the time?
I think there certainly is. At one level, of course, the play is about the fated downfall of this great heroic figure. He's in the Greek title of the play, Oedipus Tyrannos. He's not so much necessarily a tyrant as he is a sole ruler who's not in the royal line, though it turns out, ironically, at the end that he was, after all. But he is exercising sole authority in a way that is both heroic and alarming. One of the important conflicts of the play is between him and Creon, who is his brother-in-law, and obviously an important person in the state as well. When he's accused of these crimes, which he has no consciousness of having committed, Oedipus turns on Creon and says, "You're plotting to take over the kingdom." Creon says, "No, I don't want to be king. I'm very happy with the role I have now. But it is my right and my duty to speak my own mind, to tell you exactly what I do think, and you have to listen." In the exchange that I'm thinking of, the word for equality is used several times. Commentators have said it's used too often. They don't understand why it's repeated. But it's a kind of slogan of the Athenian democracy. And Oedipus is both absolutely not equal to anything, or perhaps the chorus at one point says equal to nothing. He's a singularity. He doesn't sound like, to us, like the person you would choose to be a sort of representative of humanity at large. But he's also a figure of a kind of greatness that tragedy has to accommodate, has to deal with. What do we do with these huge heroes in a society in which conceptually, we're all of us male citizens, I should say, are equal.
Right. So you've got this guy who, on the one hand, could be the tyrant who should be listening to more and more people, a kind of democratic concept as a theme in this play, but also railing or challenging the gods, which could be seen, I suppose, as challenging the cult of the gods. Is humanism now beginning to be a concept that's important to the Athenians?
Well, I'm not sure.
I mean, he loses.
He loses.
Famously.
I'm not sure that he challenges the gods in a way. What happens, of course, is that he distrusts the oracles. And this is an old tradition in Athens because apparently the oracle at Delphi sided with the Persians in the Persian War. And
it was okay to distrust
it. He's wrong. The prophecies all come true. But in the end, he recognizes that his life has been ruled by this strange fate of which he had no awareness. And he not only accepts it, he sort of takes it on. At the end of the play, the chorus asks him, or toward the end of the play, the chorus asks him why he didn't just kill himself. And he said, "I'm being saved for some even greater evil. I have some special destiny. I punished myself. I cut up my own eyes." They're astounded. They're horrified. But Oedipus is back in some strange way.
And it is his human control. He takes control of his humanity over and against the democracy and the gods.
On the other hand, now Creon is the king, and he has to accept Creon's rule. He thinks he knows exactly what he needs. He needs to go to the mountain Kithairon and die where his parents exposed him as a baby. And Creon says, "No, we didn't listen to the oracles last time, and it was a big mistake. This time, we're going to go check it out before we do anything." And he's made to go back into the palace against his will, to this place where his most horrible atrocities were committed.
Well, Jules, I want to talk with you just before we take a break here, because this is a jumping off point. But I know that you, when we talk about politics and theater, you see this discussion is divided into three parts. What are they?
Right. Well, there's political theater, which I think is obviously theater that takes the political process, usually the process of election, as well as scandal around political figures' behavior as its subject matter. And then there's politics as theater, right? So the invocation of something being just politics, a kind of staging or a falseness around what might be a genuine action but is perceived, or it's done so calculatingly that it seemed to be about perception rather than investment. And then we have this interesting sort of thing of theater itself as a political act, as a special kind of mode of communication between performers and between performers and audience that still kind of, no matter its subject matter, whether it's about a political issue or an issue of representation or it's just supposed to be not about anything, how its choices are seen politically in terms of representation.
We will explore those three ways of looking at politics and theater when our program continues. First, I want to thank Peter Burian, professor of classical studies and theater at Duke University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our conversation continues in the State of Things just ahead. We will talk more about the intersection of politics and theater on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We can see how closely politics has come to resemble theater. When we watch somebody like Vice President Joe Biden, who has a tendency, you know, to speak off the cuff, and whenever he does, we say that he has gone off script.
I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women married men are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties. And quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that.
Well, that is Joe Biden seeming to announce the administration's support of gay marriage before the president was ready. And of course, that caused a little bit of problem in the administration. So with us in the studio to talk about theater, politics, and the way the two work together is Jules Odendahl. James, she is a resident dramaturg and visiting lecturer at Duke. And joining us now is Jeffrey Baim. He is an associate professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Welcome, Jeffrey. Good to
have
you,
Frank.
Here.
Good to be here.
So what does this tell us about? Let's talk about this, because I'm actually going to ask Jules the first question, because just before the break, you gave us kind of these three versions of politics and theater. That seems to be the version of politics as theater, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the and this is a problem, I think, for theater in some sense, because it presumes that what's happening in theater is all about falsity, is about staged construction, which it is, certainly, but people are also looking for an authentic experience at the theater. And so there is a measure of truth that has to be at the core of that. And lots of people making theater without considering, overly considering, what are people going to think? We just want to, it's important for us to tell this story. And the idea that performance is all about posturing gets us into this sense that both forms of politics and theater are there simply for show. They're manipulative. They're about sort of, you can't trust anyone who participates in either of those things. And yet it's a shorthand for sort of dismissing very close examination of representation. And why are we drawn to certain politicians? Because we like them to be performers. We want them polished. We want them to be in control. There's certain aspects of theatrical management that we expect our politicians to do. But when it's in a way that we think we're being actively manipulated, then all of a sudden it's a negative.
Well, Jeffrey, what does this teach us, this particular gaffe then, about this relationship between theater and politics?
Well, it's interesting. I think Joe Biden, he comes out and he says, you know, I'm pro-gay marriage. And people react and say he's off message. And that's,
right.
I think, Jules' point, that notion that staying on message is an inauthentic, manipulative way to speak to voters. It also suggests, however, that when we try to make sense of politicians, increasingly we use the framework of theater and narrative to understand what they're doing. So the media in particular, very interested in how politicians stay on message or are knocked off message. message, this fascination with message, as if the whole point of governance is to send out messages.
And the way it's presented and whether or not you really mean it. And this, I guess, gets back to what you do as a dramaturg. What you're trying to do with the play is actually find the truth of the thing, convey this to actors, perhaps help your director say, look, there's a centerpiece here and here's some essence that you have to consider before you represent this. In other words, you want to get at some truth.
Absolutely. But I think there's a way that truth has to be responsive to context, right? So there's information that's buried or not buried, but in this text that we're all working with. And then there's the context in which we situate that text, which is something we have absolutely no control of, but we must be able to connect. We must see the connected messages that are there. So it is about being conscious of your surroundings, of your audience, of the means that are given to you in the text from the playwright, but then also how that is a living, breathing entity and is going to be received by people in ways that you can't control and expect, but you can anticipate and have a dialogue with because they don't take you off guard. You're prepared because you know what you're talking about.
So what do you make of this, Jeffrey, this fascination we have as Americans with, on the one hand, you need to be a good performer. The media spends more time gauging your performance and staying on message, and yet our abhorrence of inauthenticity. We want you to be authentic. We want you to tell the truth, and we want you to be a good actor. What do you make of that?
It's maybe one of the defining problems of our time, this question of fact versus fiction, of reality versus narrative. And we're not quite sure where any of us are located on that point anymore. So we have this simultaneous desire. And I'm thinking about this question of performance and inauthenticity, that we tend to assume when politicians perform that that's an inauthentic expression. But on the flip side, when non-political performers take on those political spaces, performance is often a way to articulate truths that we're not getting from the traditional political sphere.
So, and you've written about The Daily Show and its effect on sort of piercing the veil.
Right. And I love the clip you played from Stephen Colbert, I Am Super PAC and So Can You. That has been a fascinating episode in political media where Citizens United and the rise of Super PACs, one of the most important things to happen to our electoral system in decades. Mm-hmm. And the only person who's really out there talking about it is Stephen Colbert. But he's not just talking about it, he's performing it. Right. So it's a very interesting way of articulating critique and offering information that might be somewhat unprecedented.
And he's not just performing in a sense that, I mean, he is a consummate performer, but the idea that he has obtained, Trevor Potter is his lawyer. He is filing these documents with the FEC. He is making them available in sort of boxes for people to make their own super PACs all over the country as a critique of this system. So it's theater, but it's effective theater because it is really trying to show the mechanics by embracing them and saying, okay, you want to play this way in terms of how politics are funded? We will all do that. And in a way, sort of the repetition or the grotesqueness of it almost allows people to wake up to, or at least that I think that's the hope, mm-hmm. that this is a really dangerous decision.
But let's imagine the same form 50 years ago. Would it have been possible? And I asked the question to suggest, does this tell us something about the evolution of the audience, our media awareness, and what it takes to break through the glass of the TV?
I think so. There's a revival currently in New York of the Gore Vidal's 1960 play called The Best Man, which is essentially about John F. Kennedy's election to the White House in the new era of television and the way that television sort of made a particular kind of expectation for a politician, JFK versus Richard Nixon, the sort of sweaty mess on TV. And it's an interesting revival, but it seems sort of like a museum piece because we are so in our relationship with media is so broad and we've had 40 years of that now that those questions which they're trying to raise in relationship to a contemporary moment are not quite there because we have that discussion has gone so far, we don't even know, in a sense, kind of who we are in relationship to the sort of media narratives and what's true and what's false anymore.
And yet at the same time, we're more media literate than we used to be. You know, when Orson Welles made War of the Worlds, some people actually thought the Martians were invading. And the idea of being able to create that or that sort of susceptibility is something that I don't see anymore. So I think that we're looking for the sort of media criticism, even at the same time that we are consuming so much pre-scripted spectacle.
I don't know. We still haven't found the weapons of mass destruction, so maybe we're not as sophisticated as you think. But so we've got somebody embodying the antithesis, right? I mean, and so showing us what we need to see to break through the glass. And then you talk about a guy like Jon Stewart who just kind of reads the news and seems to cut through the language and the rhetoric of modern politics. Let's listen.
Obama has a kill list? How do we make sure we're minimizing any sort of non-supposed-to-be-killed-related kills?
We have at our disposal tools that make avoidance of civilian casualties much easier.
I guess the drones are probably doing like biometric readings and instantaneously cross-referencing databases of known criminals, and that's probably how we do it, I would guess.
President Obama has ordered that all military-age males killed within range of a drone strike be counted as enemy combatants.
Or we could just change the meaning of words. That's another way. You could just change the meaning of the word civilians. And maybe any females that we end up killing, they're not women. They're ninjas.
Jeffrey, what do you think? How does The Daily Show, and it works differently in a sense than Colbert, would you say?
Oh, definitely, definitely. But I think what Jon Stewart does so well, exactly what you played there, is he's so interested in meaning and in truth and in accountability issues that I think maybe we used to take for granted, although I'm not a historian. It's dangerous to have too much nostalgia for a time gone by. But this question of veracity and whether politicians speak truth or are willing to stand behind their words. The other thing that Jon Stewart is able to do, or his producers rather, is that they have everything is archived now. We have so much access to every spoken word, and they sift through it, and they're able to confront words with words. So this concept of discursive democracy or deliberative democracy of argument, in fact, it might be a very old thing come back around again.
I was just saying that what I love and both fear about The Daily Show is that it does it so comedically, it does it so effectively with humor that I think sometimes at least one criticism that I've had about is that how effective is it for political action, right? So he is able to puncture and sort of these notions of talking point over talking point and really exposing the repetition of this image, this manufactured image, as well as sort of dangerous policies, as we just heard in that clip. But when we laugh at it, does that release our responsibility to sort of demand action as a result of it? Or Colbert, when they had the rally for sanity in the mall as a kind of antidote to the Tea Party, people sort of poo-pooed that as two comedians sort of just having another show, as opposed to the people that attended as well as the people who constructed it really thinking about it as a meaningful political expression to say we need to get back to some meaningful actions, mediations, moderation for productive political discourse.
Well, I guess that raises the question, where does mass media fit in the whole question of theater? And how was theater effective, and was it ever effective in creating political change?
Well, and it depends on what you mean by change, right? I think there's a way that we can sort of mollify ourselves in the theater and imagine that a changed mind or exposure to an experience in one person is a political act. It has potential there because that person belongs to a larger community and might actually take steps based on that. I'm thinking of plays like The Laramie Project, which actually did for whatever sort of you might think of it as a piece of theater, it has been very effective in so much even that Matthew Shepard's name is on the federal hate crimes legislation that it was passed in Washington in 2009. Without that play, I don't know that that would have happened, partly because it is like the archive that The Daily Show has. It was a moving kind of piece that went from town to town, place to place, and kept retelling this story with new groups of people in new communities that they became invested whether they had any relationship to Wyoming or whatever their sort of perspectives on the kind of discussion of homophobia, they now had a responsibility in some way.
Jeffrey, do you see a distinction between, in terms of effectiveness or the effect that it has on us, not necessarily to make change, between mass media and live theater, where bodies are in the seats watching the performance in front of them?
I don't know that much about the difference between embodied and more sort of watching it on a screen. But I think the key question with effectiveness or effect is, do we look short term or are we interested in the big picture? So does Jon Stewart, when they do a comedic bit, result in is somebody going to vote differently tomorrow because they watched The Daily Show yesterday? Probably not. But if we look at political culture, and we have a political culture, and it evolves over time. And I think that Jon Stewart and Colbert have played a very important role. They've been on air now for, you know, many, many years. And that daily dose of rhetorical criticism, that daily dose of let's pick apart what people in the public sphere are saying, I think ultimately changes how we think about politics. Certainly not everybody, but I think there are cultural trends. And so whether the rally to restore sanity made any difference in the election that came right after, obviously it didn't. But yet I think a lot of people are learning how to be media literate, how to be critical, how to be healthfully skeptical. And that's a good thing.
Well, it also raises questions about the role of theater icons, people who are always before us in the media, and then when they take on a political role. Of course, Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger are two of the most recent that come to mind. This crossover between politics and theater is marked in many cases by politicians who recruit actors. This is the other way around, help them raise money and get people to vote for them. So joining us now by phone is Michael Cobb, an associate professor of political science at North Carolina State University. Michael, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me in the conversation.
Tell us about celebrity endorsements and fundraising. First of all, are they growing in popularity? Where are they today? Are we doing more of them, less of them?
I think it's increasing, and it's more of a strategic effort by different individual candidates and organizations. And I see a lot more on the Democrat side trying to strategically deploy celebrities to increase interest in campaign activities and fundraising. A team for Obama in particular likes to send out emails trying to solicit donations, and you may be picked at random to have dinner with George Clooney under the belief that this is something that would be quite attractive to people, and it probably is. There's very little research right now on whether or not trying to entice somebody to donate to meet George Clooney is more effective than a traditional other candidate, just meet Joe Biden.
But you have done some research on the effectiveness of celebrity endorsements. What have you found?
Right. And so far, and the research is still in its kind of infancy, it doesn't appear that celebrities are very persuasive in traditional political activities such as vote choice, and that I experimentally manipulated different famous celebrities in who they were endorsing, both Republicans and Democrats. And it wasn't changing anyone's minds about the candidates. And the more interesting thing was that it tended to hurt the image of the celebrity. So if Angelina Jolie endorsed a candidate of the opposite party as you, you tended to think she was even less attractive than if she had, you didn't know about this information. You liked her less and so forth. And so when celebrities wade into this area, they risk harming their own brand.
It's interesting, though, because if we think that we want our politicians to be celebrities and good performers, and yet we don't really connect them with, or it doesn't really help them much to be supported by a bona fide performer, what does that say about us and kind of how this decision-making process and how we view or how we weigh celebrity in our selection process?
Right. Well, in some ways, one of the criticisms that the McCain campaign made of Obama back in the day was, he's a celebrity, right? And celebrity carried the connotation of a lightweight, someone who didn't know what they were doing. And it was in reference largely to the squabble over Paris Hilton. And so and I think this is why celebrities aren't, by and large, very effective at political persuasion. They're not considered credible. They're not trustworthy sources of political information. They're great for product placement, more consumer things, but politics is not a consumer good, and so I think that the more effective things that they may do would be to, again, generate excitement. Are you more likely to attend a rally if you know Ben Affleck is there, and if you're in a 18 to 28 age demographic, you probably are.
You know, you mentioned John McCain, and Jules, I know you've had an insight into John McCain and the way he had to perform the maverick role.
Well, and I think you see a real transformation in him from when he first ran for office as the maverick and was, as the sort of continuation of his Senate career, saying a lot of things and was sort of demolished by the political machine that was behind George Bush. And so when he reappears, he still wants to carry that brand with himself. I mean, I think what Michael's talking about is a lot about politics as style. So he wants to carry that maverick brand, but he's been through an experience that has taught him that he cannot win, that he can't say that. Maverick becomes a constructed identity. And I think The Daily Show was wonderful at exposing what he said and how he was presenting himself as two very diametrically opposed things by the time he was running in 2008.
Jeffrey, what role can comedy, because we've seen the other side of this, which is the politician showing up on the entertainment shows to sort of rebrand themselves, show themselves as regular guys.
Right. And I think that we make a mistake if we want to draw firm boundaries between, let's say, consumer culture and political culture, or between news and comedy, as if these are somehow necessarily distinct or normatively should be distinct, because they're not really. I think that one of the very overlooked things about programs like Jon Stewart's and Stephen Colbert's is the quality of interviews, you know, especially when Jon Stewart says, we'll put it up on the web. So you now have 15, 20 minute, very detailed interviews. John McCain appeared on The Daily Show something like 13 or 14 times before Jon Stewart got a little tired of him and McCain realized it wasn't a friendly venue anymore. But the substance of political discussion that you can sometimes find on those shows, and sometimes they're not funny at all. Yep. So while there
it's
is the humor, there isn't always. Right.
Jeffrey Baim, I want to thank you. Jeffrey Baim from UNCG. And I also want to thank Michael Cobb, an associate professor of political science at North Carolina State. Our conversation on politics and theater continues on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour about the intersection between politics and theater. With us in the studio, Jules Odendahl James, resident dramaturg and visiting lecturer at Duke University. Joining us now is John Fitz, who is a member of Burning Coal Theater and the coordinator of its upcoming Polytheatrics Festival. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we've been talking about this relationship between politics and theater, and now we're thinking about contemporary theater and how theater actually influences, when it's deliberate about it, how it influences the political process. Tell us about the Polytheatrics Festival.
The Polytheatrics Festival is something the brainchild of our artistic director, Jerome Davis. The idea was to bring together six companies from across the United States that are doing what's called devised theater, which is a relatively new form of theater in the United States. There are a lot of discrepancies about what it is, how it's done, and a lot of times it varies company to company, but it's producing some of the most cutting-edge work in the country, really because it allows for conversation. It's built in conversation, and it's really conducive for creating audience conversation.
What's your version of it? What do you see it as doing? Obviously, conversation is part of it,
sure.
Creating dialogue, and I assume this means not only on the stage, but then including the audience.
Absolutely. We really are looking to the different topics that all these companies are coming in with. We're really looking to create. They're all talking on political themes, and we're really interested in creating a conversation with them through what do they think about this? Earlier we were talking about how theater is inherently dialogic, and we are really interested in exploring that. We want to create – we don't want didacticism. We want to create conversation with the people who are coming in, people who are affected by these issues, and people who can affect change for these issues.
Now, how open are you about this when you create these plays? Does it come from a point of view? Does it say war is bad, or does it say what do you think about war?
It depends on the companies who are producing the works. Generally, I think companies try to stay open to it, and they try to let the process bring out – they will look at a subject and see where does it lead them. But I mean, it's part of the theatrical medium that it's not we always try to come at it from an angle that isn't saying war is bad, war is good.
Right.
We're trying to say, here is what Oedipus is thinking. Here is what Jocasta is thinking. What do you think?
How is this different from mass media? And do you try to distinguish yourself now because of mass digital media, something unique to the theater, to embodied mm-hmm. theater, what you can do that no other form can do?
I think what you said in the embodiment is that we are in the room. We are in the room with people who we want to have conversation with. We are not separated by a computer screen. We're not separated by television. We're not separated by even airwaves. We're in the room with you. And there is few things that are more powerful than that. in wanting to convey a message and wanting to raise awareness and wanting to empower.
Jules, we've talked about the use of theater in actual revolutions, certainly in Serbia. This was an important part of beginning the process of getting rid of Milosevic, and it goes on elsewhere as well.
And I think one of the things that's sort of potent continually about theater is this live shared space, reacting to the cues of others, the physical cues of others, and that at moments of particularly high tension in countries all over the world where there's conflict that needs expression, that it is a big deal because, like a political protest, that could be the core of a political movement starting in that room with the performers and their audience as well. So it's almost reassuring, the fact that people still want to protest plays and want to see them censored or want to throw theater people in jail. I'm not happy about that, but at the same time, it does mark the particular mode of representation as really powerful and potent that pieces can seize upon for advocacy issues. I think we see a lot of documentary theater in the area and certainly in the United States that's very much about giving people who haven't been heard from a voice that they shape, that they have an investment in order to get a message and an experience out broadly. There's also a new, I think, devised theater is trying to also break the conventions of theater a little bit away from linear narrative, away from realism, to say that if we want a different kind of politics or a different kind of understanding, we have to have different forms of representation. And some of those, it's good for them to be experimental and not understood clearly in the moment because it's in the process of deciphering that we're actually starting to have a conversation with each other.
So give us an example about in the Polytheatrics Festival. What are some of the plays? What would we see?
Some of the plays, we have a play, What's the Cost of the Federal Budget and You? By Durham-based Haymaker, which is exploring the relationship between the average individual and the federal budget. What does that deficit mean to you? We have By Force Collision from D.C. They're performing Shape by Eric N., fantastic playwright. They're devising a performance based on that, which is about the reappropriation of race and how that affected vaudeville in the early 20th century. Children in the Dark, produced by Neutral Ground Ensemble from New Orleans, about how, as Americans, we experience fear and what that means. We have from Awkward Elephant Project, who we have with us, they're doing a performance called Blackout about censorship and what it means to be censored. We have Mark Twain's Joan of Arc, an adaptation and devised piece based on that from Urban Gardens Performing Arts, about, of course, radical political activism. And Mum's the Word from Machine Theater in Charlotte about a satire on privilege.
Well, you have brought some actors with you. Olivia Lemon is here, Alexis Floyd, and they're going to perform in one of the plays in the festival. It's called Blackout, and maybe I can ask you to do a scene and ask one of you to set it up for us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Then talk. Why are you pushing me?
I just want to talk. Can we please...
Talk to me. I'm listening.
I just want...
Stop it.
Mrs. Feldman, I would really appreciate it if... I loved your daughter. Yeah, I know everyone loved her and everyone came out of everywhere to tell her how great she was, but I loved her.
Of course.
Mrs. Feldman, you don't understand. I really loved her. She was everything to me. When I found out that she had died, I was shocked and stunned because we were finally getting to that place where we were going to tell people.
Don't. I don't want to hear it.
You've got to hear it.
I don't have to hear anything.
You need to hear this. We were a thing. We were an item. Mrs. Feldman, I was your daughter's girlfriend.
How can you? What makes you think you can say something like that to me?
Because it's true.
According to you.
There is no opinion here. I'm not trying to offend you or upset you. I just want you to know the truth. This isn't something you can just decide to know.
This is completely inappropriate.
To you, maybe. But for me, this has been a long time coming.
Olivia Lemon and Alexis Floyd performing in a scene from Blackout, one of the plays that's going to be part of Polytheatrics Festival held June 28th through July 8th at Burning Coal Theater Company's Murphy School Auditorium in Raleigh. Let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Alexis, about tell us about this play in particular, kind of what's going on here.
Sure. Well, this play actually was a result of quite a few conversations about what censorship meant to us. And then in relationship to politics, we were trying to explore how theater could be used as a tool of honesty and exploration as to where certain political actions and reactions like censorship come from in the most human sense. So in our conversations, we realized that it comes from a real need to do good for the things that you really believe in. And sometimes as a reaction of fear or misunderstanding, censorship can be used as a vehicle to sort of manipulate the way things are perceived in that way. So our play consists of three different moments, three different scenarios, if you will, of when censorship can be used to sort of strike conversation or to prohibit conversations that may be uncomfortable. And in this particular situation from the scene we just read, it's a situation in which a young girl is trying to profess a feelings or a relationship that she had with someone that may not have been socially acceptable to the family or friends, and how she herself feels censorship and what it feels like to move past that boundary.
Olivia, I'm interested to know when you participate in a play like this, if it changes your mind or allows you to think differently about a role, because the first thing an actor does is get those lines down, and then you have to think about the meaning of the play. Is this any more engaging for you as an actor, this kind of theater?
Oh, yes. And as you said, in most types of theater, we get the lines down first. I found that having it start in a conversation really brought about having the solid ideas behind us. And especially, we started out the conversation talking about how censorship affected politics and larger issues in today's media. And then we shifted and realized as we were starting to develop this, the parts of it that really hit us the most are where it was personal and how we view the world around us. So we kind of shifted our view from the politics of censorship in the modern government to the politics of self and how we censor ourselves and how we censor the ones around us and the ones we love and what we choose to hear.
Jonathan, is there anything about this kind of theater that's different for you as someone, as a director, than any other theatrical experience in terms of the art and the craft of staging a play?
Absolutely. I mean, the first obvious difference is that there is no script. Usually, you don't come in with guidelines. You don't come in with a playwright saying, this is the way to go and set this course and all will be well. You come in with a group of artists who are sometimes coming from radically different backgrounds as yourself. I've worked in devised theater with sculptors and painters, not just actors and designers. And it's exactly what they said, is you start a conversation. So you don't have rehearsal schedules are often much more different. I know that some groups are still devising even now, but that's part of the
Can you do this on Skype? Can you rehearse on Skype?
Yes.
It has been done.
There we go.
And done effectively.
Well, you know, Jules, this raises the question about this whole question of the form as the message. And I think of programs like Survivor and American Idol, these programs that reinforce the idea of competition, scarcity, there's only one. We think it's entertainment, but that's a real message that tells us this is the society you're living in and how we play our game, right?
I think, too, that what theater, at least in the devised level, is also trying to beat back the sense of theater production, which can also be very hierarchical and very non-participatory for its participants. Everyone's sort of set with the director at the top, with the playwright, and then everyone else works in service of that. Devised theater, I think, is really trying to put everyone on a kind of even keel and then also see what kind of form comes out of those conversations. It is trying to model a different way of representational working that is maybe more towards theater's ultimate democratic roots, if we want to think it that way, having those in action, which also means it's messy, it's contestatory, and sometimes the audience has to be prepared and kind of willing to set aside their expectations of sort of traditional plays and come in for an experience that is going to be something different, so that the theaters can also sort of say, we're at this point in our conversation, we have invited you in. We're not sort of finished answering all our questions and now you will come see a product.
It does seem that that might limit the audience in some ways, that there's a lot of self-selecting that would go on in screening, or no?
It can, but I do think the more that this is done, and I think this festival is a great sort of first entree into that, with a lot of local companies who've been doing devised work, but we haven't really had a festival to kind of look at and see the state of those products yet, is to encourage a whole new group of people who might be tired of seeing plays, who might see the typical theatrical experience as as empty and sort of sham as we want to argue theater is like politics. And so wanting something that is different and potentially transformative. And so they might be hungry for that. And I certainly think the more that you get exposed to it, again, you learn the vocabularies and you learn it's okay that it's not perfect and I don't have to think one thing. I can think many things out of the experience. I think it's really an exciting moment to sort of think what will come out of that, what will action and experience and understanding of the audience happen as a result of this kind of theater.
Jonathan, as you've staged these plays, what's been your reaction? Or I should say, how have you noticed audiences responding to this kind of thing? Do they actually become engaged? Do they want to talk
Absolutely.
About
Absolutely. In my experience, I've only had the opportunity to see several of these plays actually as they've come in for tech rehearsal from all around the country. But in my experience with Devise Theater, I've seen some of the most amazing conversations occur either at talkbacks after the show, online dialogues through blogs afterwards. Because it is so unusual, it's not Aristotelian typically. It's breaking away from that tradition. But like you said, it's mirroring what the current cultural consciousness is. And it's sort of pastiche in that. But it has a great resonation in that.
Well, and so if you're steeped in this political context, if this is what you've been watching and seeing, it means that we're kind of filled with sound bites. This happens on this show frequently. You'll get somebody on as a real human being, and they start talking in sound bites. And you think, well, they've been just watching too much TV, you know? And I wonder if with you, Alexis and Olivia, you know, it's one thing to say, well, we're just real people talking about what's really on our mind. But you've got your talking points. You've got things you want to say and a kind of a message. Do you find yourself having to cut through that, or is it difficult? Do you recognize now that you're not as authentic as you thought when you're doing a play like this? Anybody want to fess up to that?
I would say definitely sometimes the pressure of being on stage and when you really want to communicate an idea that you and those you've been working with feel passionate about, that sometimes you do feel a barrier or a hesitation to find the real honesty. But I think one of the wonderful things about Devise Theater is that your voice really is in the writing, in the text mm-hmm. itself, and that when you are ready to present it on stage, it's really come from a very meaningful part of you. And I think through that development, it's been easier in work like this to really feel honest and present.
It's interesting that you would create, and I think it's important to create a kind of an artifice, a structure in which you can go through the levels of self to get to something that feels
Absolutely.
A little more authentic.
Absolutely. And a lot of times that process of the artists working through that finds itself in the performance. So the audience is not only watching a performance, they're also watching the process. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic that the audience is able to participate in that way, even if they're just sitting in a chair or if they're up on stage dancing.
So, Jules, here we go into the selection. Were you going to say something?
Well, I was just thinking about there's another mechanism of Devise Theater, and it's even, I think, more nascent than Devise Theater is, even if that's possible. But work where theater companies are actually trying to use theater as a means by which to engage democratic dialogue, civic dialogue with one another, and not towards a product, not towards a play, but towards interaction, sort of relearning how to have a conversation, how to dialogue, particularly from ideologically diverse groups of people. One of them is Town Hall Nation, which is a product of Sojourn Theater and a company in New York called The Team, which they have sort of been working since January, following the political process and trying to ask people, how do you have a conversation? How can we talk? And that even doing that is a political act.
Well, I thank you all for your part in this conversation. Jules Odendahl James, resident dramaturg, visiting lecturer at Duke University. Jonathan Fitz is a member of Burning Coal Theater, coordinator of the upcoming Polytheatrics Festival. Olivia Lemon and Alexis Floyd are appearing in Blackout, which is one of the plays at the Polytheatrics Festival. That festival held June 28th to July 8th at the Murphy School Auditorium in Raleigh. For more information, go to burningcoal.org. And that's our program for today. Our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.